Ooh, sorry. Start again. Good evening. We're up to History of the Talmud, Chapter 19. We just finished the three classes that I gave on the Bar Kokhba revolt. There were the two on the first 2 years of the revolt when they were winning, the second 2 years of the revolt when they were losing bad, and then the aftermath of the revolt when Hadrian had his horrible decrees that ultimately broke the will of the Jewish people. In the wake of the Bar Kokhba revolt, so Hadrian does a great deal to try to make sure that the Jews will never revolt again. We spoke about the horrible decrees, the killing of Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Hanina ben Trajon, the pernicious attempt to break the will of the Jewish people, that ultimately they would never try to revolt again. And to a certain extent he was successful, because he totally shifts perspective of the Jewish people. We said for a good 2,000 years, you would have to say probably somewhere around Theodore Herzl time, suddenly someone came up with an idea that maybe we should try to rebuild our commonwealth. But that's a pretty good reverberating success rate if you think about it. If you can say you can make you could do something that will change a national character for 1,700 years, Hadrian was highly successful in that sense. In another sense, he wasn't successful because the rabbis of the time were aware of what he was doing and built in a system that would ultimately carry the people in a non-governmental capacity. They would be able to continue to live by slight modifications in terms of the way tradition was transferred and translated. We spoke about the democratization of halacha and of Talmud study. We spoke about the attempt to educate more people, to create takanot, to create certain types of decrees that would ultimately give more power to the people and also more of a protection and a defense of the Jewish people in the exile. One of the, I guess, unintended consequences and one of kind of the shameful consequences, as we'll see, is in the wake of the Hadrianic decrees, you have a mass exodus from the land of Israel. Yavne is gone. You have a decision by most of these scholars to move north to places like Tiberias and Tzipori, etc. And you also have a migration towards Bavel, which we'll talk about, Rabbi Yehuda ben Bentera, why he's an important figure there. So we'll start with why this happens, and a lot of it happens because of a housing crisis. There is a purposeful attempt by Hadrian to drive original landowners out of their land and to resell the properties, but the prices are pushed down and no one wants to buy them. It's a horrible situation, and it's recorded in the Talmud Yerushalmi in Gittin Perek Vav Halacha Zayin. The Talmud Yerushalmi says as follows: in the beginning, the Romans decreed oppression against Judea, for they had a tradition in their hands from their forefathers that Judah had slain Esau, for it is written, your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies. Right, that is the bracha. So here, again, in classic rabbinical fashion, they put everything in religious perspective. Why did the Romans make this horrible decree of oppression against the Jews? Not because of the rebellion, but because of the fulfillment of the brachos given to Yaakov and Esav years and years ago. Right? They viewed their lives like that. I once I read a book in college. Maybe it was one of these Puritan works. Fascinating. And just about some of the struggles and tragedies that they were going through in the early days of the settlement in the colonies, you know, United States of America. And one of the fascinating things that they do is through each event, one person will turn to the other and say, "Will you read?" And they open up a section of the Bible that will, you know, kind of relates to what they're going through. And this was part of the way, you know, the Puritans were getting this from somewhere. They were getting it from Rabbinic Judaism. Because if you look throughout Rabbinic Judaism, whenever anyone goes through anything, they'll look for the proper text or verse in Tanakh, which will ultimately capture what it is that they're feeling, to the point where they'll even manipulate some verses to fit what it is they're feeling in, I guess, creative rabbinic fashion. But it's sad that we don't have that anymore. That we don't have that type of perspective. But here, Chazal were going through the struggles with Rome, and they automatically related it to the struggle between Yaakov and Esau. It's just it's something that will carry the Jewish people for many generations. It's unfortunate. It's kind of been lost in this day and age. You know, how often do we go through something in our lives and you know, recite the chapter and verse that it most relates to? It's kind of sad. So now they went and they subjugated the Jews and took their fields and sold them to others. Then the original householders came and seized the field, and the land was tied up in the hands of usurping occupants, the Sikarikon. The Sikarikon, in order to prevent the original homeowners from being able to buy back their lands, they basically refused to move until they would extract large sums of money from the original owners. They're people who profit off of the destruction of others. They came in the wake of Rome's kind of making hefker, making ownerless all the properties. They came in and they kind of making it difficult for people to buy. So no one wanted to live there anymore, because why would you want to have to deal with these people where potentially they're like mobsters? You know, you have to pay a tribute or something to them in order to buy the land. And people refrain from buying the land. So what happens is no one wants to buy. There's no demand. So the prices of land keep on falling. So if you were able to buy back your land now, your land is worthless because everybody is moving north. They ordained that the law of the usurping occupant should not apply in Judea. So they tried to, even Rome tried to stop the Sikarikon. Under what circumstances? In the case of those who were slain in the war and thenceforth, the law of usurping occupant does not apply. They attempted to ameliorate it by removing the law, but it was unsuccessful. The damage had already been done, and you have the Jewish community moving north and heading towards Babylon, which was more opportunity. What made the Babylonian existence greater opportunity? Well, number one is, if we remember all the way back to 115 CE and 116 CE, remember Trajan had attempted to capture Babylon, had attempted to move into that area, but had failed miserably. And Hadrian, when he took over, made it his policy not to extend his army east. So the attraction was, A, in places like Neharda, and we're going to talk about Nitzarin, those were places that had a fair amount of freedom from Roman rule and Roman oppression, and it also had opportunities, and there was already an established Jewish community that, remember, is years and years and generations old already, that's living there. Not only that, but you also have a reputation. You're not going into a wasteland. You know, you're not going into the middle of nowhere where you're going to have to build your shul, you're going to have to do everything. They have their academies, they have their learning, they have their shuls, they have their schools, they have an entire community already built up for you. So the attraction to someone is, well, I can stay here in the land of Israel and deal with the Roman occupation, or I can head east and to better living in Babylon. You know, I could get a nice, you know, colonial with a 2-car garage. You know what I mean? I could have all the things that I'm looking for. Where in Israel, I'm going to have to live in who knows what, a 2-bedroom flat. You know that I'll pay the same price. You know, it's not the same price for the same house in Babylonia. So it's not worth it for a lot of people. And what happens? The Gemara in Sanhedrin, Daf Lamed Bet Amud Bet, tells us that there was a mass exodus, particularly a brain drain, if you would, of some of the rabbinic leadership from the center of the land of Israel. Our rabbis talked, tzedek, tzedek, tirdof, righteousness, righteousness shall you pursue, Devarim 16:20 says. This teaches that one should go after the sage to the place of the yeshiva to have his case adjudicated. So where did the yeshiva go? The yeshiva is not in Yerushalayim. For example, after Rabbi Eliezer went to the town of Lod, right? That's on the coast. And Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai went to the town of Bor Hayil, also on the coast. Rabbi Yeshua to Bekin, and after Rabbi Gamliel to Yavne, after Rabbi Akiva to Bnei Brak, they're heading all to the coast. And then we have Rabbi Matya going to Rome. Again, there's an ancient Roman community also, which actually a good portion of Ashkenazim may be descendant from that community. after Rabbi Chanina ben Trajan to Sichni, and then as you start to get later in the period of time to where we are, somewhere around 138, 139, 140 CE, after Rabbi Yossi to Tzipori, and after Rabbi Yehuda ben Beteira, and this is the interesting one, to Netzivin. And after Rabbi Yeshua to the exile, and after Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi to Beit Sha'arim, and after the sages to the chamber of Yumstone. What you have here is the Gemara in Sanhedrin talking about a good portion of time of 70 CE until probably around 141, 142 CE, that you have here a good 70 years of massive movement of the scholarship and the scholars of the time. You have the scholars heading from, let's say, the center of the land of Israel, Jerusalem, and its surrounding areas, the chamber of Yunstone, the Lishkat HaGazit, and then you have them moving first to the coast, right, that Yavne is on the coast, Lod is on the coast, Bnei Brak is, you know, right near Tel Aviv today, those areas, heading towards those areas, and then you have them after the Bar Kokhba revolt continuing the movement north, until you have Rabbi Yehuda ben Beteira heading all the way to Netzirin, and also Rabbi Yehoshua heading all the way to exile. It's interesting, it mentions as the last one is Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. We know that Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, he was in the land of Israel. He is the redactor, the great editor of the Mishnah, someone who we'll spend a lot of time on. But Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi is going to kind of reestablish, at least for a brief moment in time, the scholarship in the land of Israel until one of his great students or students of students, Rav, heads across the Fertile Crescent all the way to Babylonia, where the Babylonian Talmud would ultimately be formed, and scholarship will kind of move its center totally from there. Rabbi Yehuda ben Beteira is an important character. Why is he an important character? If you remember all the way back to when we started, probably in like shir number 3 or shir number 4, we spoke about Hillel, right? And when Hillel comes up from Babylonia, who is it that is depicted as the leader of the Jewish people? Bnei Beteira. So Bnei Beteira seemed to be this very scholarly family, a family that has for many years taken upon itself the mantle of leadership, particular Torah leadership of the Jewish people. So when Rabbi Yehuda ben Beteira leaves the land of Israel, the land of Israel to head to Babylonia, this can potentially be a massive blow for the Jewish people. Imagine if, you know, some of the greatest scholars of the time, imagine if in the early days of the Yeshuv HaYashan, Rav Kook had picked up and said, I heard there's a great job for me in New York, and I'm going to go take a job in New York. Imagine what a psychological blow that would have been for the Yeshuv HaYashan, for the people who were attempting to build something in the land of Israel. Imagine how monumental that would have been. And so imagine how they must have felt when Rav Yehuda ben Beteira picks up and he takes his, you know, his scholarship and everything that he stands for and this long tradition of scholarship, and he heads towards Babylonia. It's kind of captured by the Midrash Sifri, by the Sifri and Devarim in Perek Pei. The Sifri says as follows: "And you have dispossessed them and settled in their land." The Pasuk in Devarim, Perek Yud Bet, Pasuk Chavtet says, "It once happened that Rav Yehuda ben Beteira, Rav Matya ben Cheresh, Rav Chananya, son of the brother of Rabbi Yeshua, and Rabbi Yonatan were going abroad. When they reached Platana and remembered the land of Israel, they raised their heads heavenward and wept and rent their garments and recited the verse, 'When you have occupied it and are settled in it, take care to observe all the laws and rules that I have set before you this day.'" What are they saying? They're recognizing that there is something qualitatively special, unique, singular, to dwelling in the land of Israel and keeping mitzvot there. But that was being lost now as they were heading outside of the land of Israel. They felt, perhaps just as passionately as the day the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed, that they were severing a connection that they had with God. They said the duty of dwelling in the land of Israel is equivalent to all of the commandments in the Torah put together. They understood, you know, you see this a lot in Rashi, and again, one thing you have to remember about Rashi, one of his great beauties and elegance, is the fact that Rashi is really the true next generation after rabbinic literature. He picks up where Midrash left off, in many senses of the word. The Gaonim had their own perspective. The Rambam has his own perspective, but Rashi really, you know, particularly in his commentary on the Torah, Rashi was, you know, sometimes you say about Sir Rav Meidan, always used to say about his father, who was one of the editors of the Koran Tanakh, that you got the feeling when my father was learning Tanakh, that he was, you know, back in the days of the Nevi'im, walking next to Yishayahu, Yirmiyahu, Yechezkel, etc., and reporting what was happening, you know, from an existence there. You get the feeling when you read Rashi that he is, you know, sitting at the table with Rabbi Yeshua and Rabbi Yochanan and all of those people. He's really, you know, dwelling on, you know, that's how Rashi had this sense of rabbinic literature that is beyond us. But Rashi, in a number of places, in his commentary on Chumash, talks about how there's a qualitative lack in the performance of mitzvot outside of the land of Israel, that there's something really missing. You know, when you take a lulav in America, it's not the same as taking a lulav in Eretz Yisrael. When you eat matzah in America, it's not the same as when you eat matzah in the land of Israel. When you daven in America, it's not the same as when you daven in Israel. I forgot who was it who told me the joke recently that they dug down deep in France and they found. Wait, did you tell this thing? Wasn't it real? They dug down deep in France, about 1,000 feet, and they discovered a wire, you know, from 1,000 years ago. And they said, oh my goodness, 1,000 years ago, they must have had some sort of basic level of telecommunications in France. Britain, not to be outdone, dug down 2,000 feet, and they found what looked like fiber optic wires, right? And they said, oh my goodness, in Britain, we must have had fiber optics 2,000 years ago. In Israel, not to be outdone, they dug down 3,000 feet, and they discovered nothing. And they said, my goodness, we had Wi-Fi even then. Okay, so that's the that was the old joke. But you laugh, or it's like the other joke about how, you know, calls to heaven are local in the land of Israel, but they were very much feeling the loss of the connection that existed when living in the land of Israel. And what you begin to discover during this time, this is something that Yishayahu Gafni and others point out, what you begin to discover in this time is a concerted effort to praise the quality of life in the land of Israel. You have, of course, the Talmudic discussions in the end of Ketubot, which are much later discussions. Those are Babylonian discussions. But those Babylonian discussions are very much built off a fascinating Tosefta, and with this I'll end, in Avodah Zarah, Perek Hei Halacha Bet. The Tosefta says, Yashre Adam Be'eretz Yisrael, Afil Be'ir Sheruba Ovdei Kochavim. It's better to live in the land of Israel, even in a city that is mostly idolaters. V'lo b'chutz la'aretz, and certainly not in the land of outside the land of Israel. Afilu b'ir shekula Yisrael, even if you're going to move to even if you have the choice, you could live in the five towns, or you can live in Muncie, okay? You could live in the Boca, you could live in Boca, or you could live in I'm trying to think. No, in a place in the land of Israel. I don't know, in some Druze city in the Galil. So where's it better to live? In the Druze city in the Galil, that's where it's better to live. Right? If you're willing to give up on the Jewish community, which is perhaps one of our most essential values, so then it proves that dwelling in the land of Israel is comparable to keeping all of the mitzvos. Being buried in the land of Israel is like being buried under the altar. Right? You can't go out to the land of Israel unless the prices are so expensive that you have to buy two things of wheat for a sela, which apparently was an exorbitant amount. He says that's only if you're poor, right? If you can't afford it, if you really, really can't afford it. He says, but if you can scrape together the money to be able to live there, then you got to live there. And here's where it's interesting, because you have here Rabbi Shimon, who is a student of Rabbi Akiva, piping up on this one. Remember, this is the generation afterwards, right? Rabbi Akiva's students have died either during the Bar Kokhba revolt or in the decrees that came after the Bar Kokhba revolt. But you have Rabbi Shimon kind of carrying the mantle of Rabbi Akiva. And here, who does he take a shot at? This is the first time you're going to see him taking a shot at who? At Elimelech. Elimelech, the father-in-law of Rus, right? And here you're having the same situation. You have people leaving the land of Israel because of economic hardships, because of personal hardships. It says, V'chein haya Rabbi Shimon Omer Elimelech migdolei hador miparnasei hatzibur haya. Right? Elimelech was one of the great men of his generation, and he was one of the wealthy people who helped economically. V'al sheyatzal l'chutz al ha'aretz meis hu uvanav b'ra'av. Right? What happens? He died in starvation. And right, and all the people who stayed during the big drought in the land of Israel, they were fine. Right? What does it say in the pasuk? Vatahom kol ha'ir, the entire city, meaning the same city that he left, everyone was still living, and everyone was fine. And he who left to find greener pastures out of Babylonia was fine. What died? Right, Yaakov famously says, right, in his promise, he says, "Return me to this land, and then God will be for me a God." Right, I will give you the land of Canaan in order that I will be your God. Right, if you're living in the land of Israel, I am your God. Ain atem be'eretz Canaan, you're not in the land of Canaan. Eini lachem le'eloha, I'm not your God. V'cheinu omer k'arba'im el chalutzei tzava. V'omer k'natan bi'adi et yoshvei ha'aretz, k'alta al da'atcha sh'Yisrael mechabshim et ha'aretz lefnei ha'makom, ela kol zman sh'aleha kula nechbesha, ein aleha kula ein nechbesha. Again to Yoshua, he says, when you're living on the land of Israel, it'll be conquered, but no one else will ever be able to conquer that land. So he says, they chased me away from being able to dwell in the Nachala, in the area of God. Right? Could it be that David was an idolater? Anyone who leaves the land of Israel during a time of peace, right, it's as if he is committing idolatry. You continue on. Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar Amer, Yisrael shebechutz al haaretz oved avodat kochavim b'tahara hein. Ketzad oved kochavim shasa mishtel livno v'alach v'zimein kol ha'yodim shebiro. Af al pishein ochlim v'shalem v'shotin Hashem v'shamash alahem omed al gabam oved avodat kochavim behein hein shenemar v'kara lecha v'achalta mizbecho. He says a Jew is living in the land of Israel. He serves, he's an idolater with purity. Why? Says his neighbor, who's not Jewish, invites him over for a meal. And even though he has the special kosher meal, and he has the special kosher drink, and he has everything special kosher and the special wrapping, he says, the fact that you have an idolater looking over you, says you might as well be an idolater as well. What you have here all of a sudden is a massive turn in the experience of the Jewish people, is that there is a recognition that they are leaving the land, that the future of the Jewish people, at least the immediate future, is not going to be in the land of Israel. And that was a rough thing for them to accept. You have the Bnei Beteira leaving, you have Rabbi Yehuda ben Beteira leaving for Babel, you have this kind of establishing community in Nahar Adah that's building, you have the area around Yerushalayim kind of becoming Judenrein, you have this movement away from the center of the Jewish people, which had for so many years, even the first exile when they were there, the center of the Jewish people was still the land of Israel. There was the expectation that they would be back, and all of a sudden you have this movement away from it. This is a massive blow within the history of the Jewish people. This is a massive blow to the entire experience.
This is about 140?
This is about 140 CE.
So, but there was always some presence.
There was always some presence. Like I said, the center of the Jewish people was moving, and everyone could feel it. And one of the worst experiences that you can have, history is always better experienced when you don't see the change. But when you are aware of the change and experience the change, all of a sudden, everything that that is said and that is done as that is experienced, so all of a sudden becomes that much more powerful. One thing you can say about the Rabbanim, the scholars of this time, is that they were very aware of the revolutions that were going on around them. So to a certain extent, they embraced the opportunities of the Torah revolution that was going on around them. But along with the Torah revolution that was going on around them was also a national political revolution where the center of the Jewish people was changing. It was lucky that the two went on together, because now the new center of the Jewish people is kind of a traveling center. It's the Torah of the Jewish people, which is going to become the center, their keeper, as they move on in life. So they were, that it was fortuitous, if not prophetic, by the scholars, that they turned that into their priority. But nonetheless, there's a tragedy that exists in the national character changing. And I think that's what's coming out of these experiences. They're recognizing that they've lost equality to the Jewish people by this lack of nationalism. Equality, just to say, that you can see us struggling to try to recapture to this very day. You know, what are the wars, let's say, that are, I won't call them wars, what are the conflicts, the political conflicts in the land of Israel, if not the relationship between the Torah, which has been our center for so long, to now more of a nationalistic existence, which is kind of has been reemerging over the last 60, 70 years in the land of Israel. You know, to a certain extent, those who are saying that we don't want to serve in the army or we don't have to serve in the army because Torah is our protection, they're not wrong, because for 1,700 years, or more than that, 1,800 years, it has been our protection. That has been our center. And now the center is shifting, and what we're seeing now a lot is the kind of the struggles, or the hopefully the birthing pangs of some sort of new center being created where we can balance the two.
But that assumes, that whole point of view assumes, that nationalism and Torah cannot coexist.
I believe they can. No,
I personally, but I'm saying the assumption that Torah is it, and forget about the government, forget about Israel, which is their point of view.
So for hundreds of years, during the time of David HaMelech and during the time of the Hashmonaim and during the time of various means, so nationalism and Torah did coexist very comfortably. The problem is that we're trying to shift a paradigm, and to say we're just going to do that we're going to undo, you know, 1,800 years of history of shared religious experience. We're going to undo it in, you know, with one law or in 5 years is bold.
It's both sides are wrong, because the Haredim claim that Torah is what counts. Forget about Israel. Well, they're saying separate the two. The government says, well, we are the government. You do what we want. They are at least performing, maybe separating the two. So they're both wrong.
Correct. And it's going. The challenge of our generation is going to be creating some sort of balance between the two. That's. It could be the challenge of the next three generations. You know, I heard Rav Carmel from I forget the organization that he works from, but a brilliant, wonderful scholar, Rav Carmel, said. He said, from the time Yehoshua, right, so a very similar type of transition. You have them transitioning from the desert. So how many years was it between Yehoshua and David HaMelech when the Commonwealth was finally really established?
500.
About 300 years. We're way ahead of the game if you think about it. Right. If it took them 300 years, and that's with prophecy, and with everything else that they had going for them, and we're doing it without prophecy, without, you know, miracles, without any of this other things. So I mean, we're doing pretty well. You know, we should pat ourselves on the back. We're doing much better. You know, we have not been overtaken by the Plishtim yet. You know, the Philistines have seemed to stay away from us. Or, you know, we haven't had the you know, falling into total idolatry and things like that. We've been doing well from that perspective. Yeah.
There was a missed opportunity, though, after between 1920 and 1935 to make an exodus from Europe when we still could.
Hindsight's 2020, Sam. Hindsight's 2020. You know, like they debated it at the time, and they made their decision based on the information that they had before him. You know, when my father's family they were in a DP camp in Ulm, Germany, and they had a choice. They could either go to half the family was in the land of Israel, and the other half was in America. And so they wrote letters to both, and the family in Israel said, "We're starving. We have no food. We have no anything. Don't come here." So they all went to America. Meanwhile, my family in Israel are now multimillionaires. Okay, but you know what I mean? My grandfather made the best decision he could at the time. It seemed, you know, the Brownsville seemed like a better option than Tel Aviv at the time. You know, so yeah. All right, Shkaya.